So we're in Daniel chapter 2 tonight, and it's an incredible chapter. John, if you'd read verse 1, and then we'll pass it down to Zach, since Greg can't read, and blame it on glasses. But
I blame it on bad eyes, not the glasses. Glasses are fine, so, you know, I rough house the kids.
Yeah, I was thinking it was a comprehension issue.
It was that too.
Right.
For Ray?
Yes, sir.
In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him.
2. Then the king gave orders to call in the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king.
Verse 3. And the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants.
The dream, and we will give the interpretation. Verse 5. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut into pieces, or in pieces, and your house shall be made an ash heap.
Verse 6. If you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore show me the dream and its interpretation.
Verse 7. They answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation of it.
Verse 8. The king answered and said, I know of a certainty that ye would gain the time, because ye see the thing is gone from me.
Verse 9. If you do not tell me the dream, there is only one currency for you. You have conspired to tell me which leading and which things, hoping the situation may change. So then, tell me the dream, and I will know that you can interpret it for me.
And the Chaldeans answered before the king and said, there is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore, there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asks such things at any magician or astrologer or Chaldean.
11. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, he words, and they do not live among men.
Verse 12. Because of this, the king was angry and very furious and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed.
13. The decree was issued that the wise men were to be executed, and they searched for Daniel and his friends to execute them.
14. Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon.
Okay, some more I can read, I skip, okay?
Okay.
Yeah. He declared to
Arioch,
the king's captain, why is the decree of the king so
urgent
than
Arioch
make the matter known to Daniel.
Thanks, sister.
Verse 16. Then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time, and that he would show the king the interpretation.
17. James.
Then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions.
All right, Alex.
He told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon.
19. Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven.
20. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his.
21. He changes times and seasons. He moves kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding.
22. He reveals deep in him the things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him.
23. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might.
destroy the life in Babylon. He went and said unto him, do not destroy the life in Babylon. Take it from the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation.
25. Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king and came, and said thus unto him, I have found a man of the house of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation.
26. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen, and the interpretation thereof?
27. Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret was the king of the man, and not the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers, show unto the king.
28. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dreams and the visions of your head upon your bed were these.
Verse 29. To you, O king, as you lay in bed, came thoughts of what would be after this. And he who reveals mysteries made known to you what is to be.
Verse 30. But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me, because I have more wisdom than anyone living. But for our sake, we who make known the interpretation to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart.
31. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. 32. The head of this image was of fine gold, its chest and arms silver, its middle and thighs bronze.
33. Its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay.
34. You continued looking until a stone was cut out, was without hands, and it struck the statue on the feet of iron and clay and crushed them.
35. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth.
36. This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king.
37. You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, and the might, and the glory.
38. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given unto thy hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold.
39. And after thee shall arise another kingdom, inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth.
40. Finally, there will be a fourth king, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks the kings in pieces, so it will crush and break all the others.
41. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of the potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with the miry clay.
42. As the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle.
43. As he saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay.
44. In the days of those kings, the God of the heavens will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, and this kingdom will not be left to another people. It will crush all these kingdoms and bring them to end, but will itself endure forever.
45. Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, a great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation sure.
47. Then the king fell upon his face and paid homage to Daniel and commanded an offering and incense be offered up to him.
Verse 47. The king answered unto Daniel and said, Of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods, and a Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldst reveal this secret.
48.
Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, and the chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon.
49. Daniel made a request to the king. He appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel remained at the king's court.
All right, very good. May the Lord add his blessing to his word. Father God in heaven, we ask that you would guide and direct our conversation and our study and our interaction. In Jesus' name, amen. Go ahead, Sandy. Get us started.
Okay. It was the second year of the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar. And he had a dream. He had several dreams, and he couldn't interpret them. He asked for all of his people to come and help, and they all said they would, but they first wanted to know what the dream was. And I think he was suspicious, King Nebuchadnezzar was, and said, "No, you tell me what I dreamed." And they couldn't do that, so Daniel could.
All right, nice summation. Thoughts on this chapter? Ernie?
Why I even want to kill Shadrach and all of those, how he had some of the speak.
All right, let's deal with that.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if, you know, when he called all these astrologers, magicians, Chaldeans, whatever, the students that had come from Israel hadn't been called in, yet later on they were going to be killed with part of the wise men, but they hadn't been given a chance to to answer. So how did they get
lumped into that group?
One of the things that I think kind of impressed on me about King Nebuchadnezzar is that he's very impulsive, he's hot-headed, and he just thinks, "Oh, I don't like what you're saying, you can't answer me, you're gone." So, like you said, not thinking about how much money did it cost him to train these people, and how many people, and all of a sudden, all the wise people are going to be killed. Who's going to be wise in the province then? Who's he going to put to be the leader of whatever he plans? So I think from towards the end there, it made me feel like Daniel had a lot of influence on Nebuchadnezzar, because all of a sudden, just because Daniel said, "Don't kill these guys, I have the answer," and it made me remember how even if you think that you might be a minority, you do have a voice to make an influence on people who think that they know everything, but at the same time, because they realize that they're probably not in a, like, for example, Nebuchadnezzar, he knew, I think, that he wasn't making a wise decision trying to kill everybody that he put in those positions. And Daniel ended up being put in a big position just because he was calm, he was respectful, even though for a little bit he seemed like he was being rebellious. He was actually giving reason, and because of what he proved, of what he knew about the dream because of God, he not only showed that the credit wasn't towards him, but to God. And he earned a lot of credit, even for Nebuchadnezzar, even though Nebuchadnezzar is somebody who's just, "Oh, I'm just going to do whatever I feel like doing because I'm the boss and I can just, you know." But I guess for me personally, I just felt that Daniel, he had a big influence on Nebuchadnezzar, basically.
Nebuchadnezzar, the ruler, relied upon the discussion of his dreams in order to implement however he was going to rule in the future. And so without that information, he was dead in the water. So he needed that, and he got it from Daniel. And he was, that's what I thought was interesting, praising the gods, where he recognized that Daniel had a god. And he was beginning to think about how important that god is in order for him to be able to continue on his role as a ruler.
All right.
Yo, I was saying, unless he thought he wasn't going to have any more dreams, that it makes sense to kill all of his.
No, but you're expecting him to make sense.
Yeah.
And he's not going to make sense. He's a tyrant.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, he's he doesn't value life.
He does value power.
Yes.
And when the interpretation, which was, if it had to be miraculous, there's a God behind it, that got his attention. And now all of a sudden Daniel's his best friend. But it's all about the fact that somebody up there is more powerful than you.
Right.
One of the things, when I was doing some research, there seemed to be like two schools of thought on Nebuchadnezzar. One is that he had the dream, but he woke up and he couldn't remember it. God gave it to him, but he took it back. And that made him really anxious and stuff. The other one is, he knew the dream, he remembered the dream, but he's being very wise to, like you said, if you tell me the dream and the interpretation, I know you're on point.
Yes, Sean?
I mean, I can't, when I look at this, I can't really speak into silence because I don't have the historics in the scriptures right here in front of me about his Nebuchadnezzar's interactions with his astrologers and his magicians prior to this very moment. But it would appear to me, and just by the simple fact that they're astrologers and they're magicians, they probably have failed him a few times in the past where he had put his weight into what they were saying. And then and at this point, he was aware of it enough to say, okay, I have a serious issue. Not trying to give the guy any kind of credit, but he's like, I have a serious issue. I'm trying to resolve this problem, and I'm used to getting this a line from you that's not accurate. So that's probably, in my opinion, I think, or at least that's the way I would have to guess why he would want to destroy all of them, because he just lumps them all into one. I have all these guys, I've never been successful with them, and then I'm going to get rid of them. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of logically, but I don't want to speak into silence because I don't have that.
Karen. You just took it all away from me.
Sorry.
Obviously, he had dealings and been disappointed by his wife in the past. They must have lied to him or given him bad information, because this time he was saying, you either give me the answer to my dream or I will kill you. I think he just had up to here with their lies and their deceit, their corruption.
Yes, sir, and again.
Well, it could be possible, they said, in the 7th year, maybe the first 2 years he didn't have dreams, and maybe the astrologers and all that stuff had fooled him and told him, I can do this for you and I can do that. And then he did have a dream, they couldn't.
Perhaps. A lot of speculation at this point. Yeah.
I mean, in verse 8, the king answered and said, I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see that the word from me is firm. So he knew that they were trying to be deceitful. And they knew that they were going to be deceitful. This is intentional on their part, that they wanted to deceive him, and they knew what they were doing. They knew that they were saying that they knew they couldn't interpret the dream. And even though they knew they couldn't interpret the dream, they still said they were going to interpret it. And he knew that was a lie. And then at the end, they come back and say, oh, yeah, well, nobody can do it anyway. So now it confirms his suspicion of them. In his anger, he kills them. And second, it reminded me of 2 Kings, the story of Zedekiah. I mean, the Babylonians were so, just barbaric that they pulled the eyes of his sons out right in front of Zedekiah. And then, or killed his sons right in front of him, and that was the last thing that he saw, pulled his eyes out, and took them to sleep. So that's, I mean, they're barbaric. And he was, like Angela said, I mean, he's off the cuff. He was doing whatever he was going to do, impulsive.
So. That kind of gives the question then why even bring them in the first place. But I just thought it was interesting in verse 20, in chapter 1, it said, in all matters of wisdom and understanding, that the king examined them, he found them, talking about Daniel and his friends, 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers. So I guess that's kind of the question, why even bring them in?
Yeah.
You know, why just not put Daniel in?
Mm-hmm.
He just seems like he's... what was the word that... Oh, yeah, but, you know, where you're... What's the term for that? When, impulsive, yes. His mood is always, you know, from one thing to the next.
This was an ambush, is what it was. He had fought with these guys. This is his second year in power. He's given them a chance. They've never really come through for him. It's time to be done away with it. Get some new blood in there. Now, the big question is, why was Daniel and his friends not included? That, to me, is our great mystery.
But he clearly understood that, you know, because he was able to position him for a time to see him. So, you know, he started out by knowing that when he examined them that they were 10 times better. He's called the bluff of the magicians, and now, you know, he's not lost so much control of himself that he's not realizing that, you know, Daniel and his friends have the opportunity, you know, to give him the correct interpretation. And we very clearly see the sovereignty of God and saying, you know, Daniel was going to be given this, and then this is how it played out from the human perspective.
Ernie again.
Well, according to 27, I don't think they were trying to pull the wool over his eyes, because Daniel even told him no wise man could tell him the dream.
No, Daniel didn't say that. Daniel's not involved yet at that early stage.
But what's 27? Verse 27, what
is this? Oh, this is where Daniel gives credit to God. Yeah. No wise man, enchanter, magician, astrologer can show the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals. Right. So at that moment, right, God, he gives credit to God.
Verse 13, he's going to kill everybody, including Daniel.
Yes. Yes.
He had not given him an opportunity to even talk to him. So
why is that?
That's a good question.
They're just young boys. I mean, that's
one thing about the all the other enchanters and stuff like that. He's already dealt with them enough. Maybe this is his way of putting them on the chopping block anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, all right, let me see if he got it this time. You know what I'm saying? Put her out.
But what's the reasonable answer to the question, why doesn't he just go to Nebuchadnezzar right away? Why doesn't he go to Daniel right away?
Right.
Or why doesn't... What's the reasonable answer? Angela?
Possibly it's a cultural practice back then, in the time that the procedure that they normally do is to go to the king wisdom to other persons, like the astrologer and so forth, in order to determine the decision for the community.
Right.
Seems like these guys, this is in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. These guys were still studying. These guys weren't, you know, seen as guys that could answer his questions yet. So, from what I'm gathering is, it's his second year. He's still going to go to the Chaldeans, and he's still going to go to the sorcerers, and then he sees that they cannot interpret the dream. So then Daniel comes and says he can interpret the dream, and then that's why I believe that. He said, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better. Possibly, since we don't have a timeline, what I'm gathering is that first, on that second year, these guys are still studying. Then that means that Nebuchadnezzar now sees that they are well studied. They are well, have wisdom and now have understanding, and so he sees them as better in every matter of wisdom.
Right, so you're suggesting that we're going back in time. Chapter 2 is going back.
Yes.
Right.
That's a possibility, but
one of the commentaries I read was that when they first came, that and maybe I misinterpreted this, but that Nebuchadnezzar didn't take over right away, that his father was actually in power when the boys were taken, and Nebuchadnezzar had learned about his father's death and went back, you know, after his father died, and the boys at this point had already been learning. There was also some discussion that the Hebrew way of keeping track of years, that right. 3 years that they were studying would be portions of years.
Right.
So it's not necessarily 3 full years, and that the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign was more the Chaldean way of keeping track, because now Daniel's, you know, writing this from the Chaldean perspective, and it's a, it could be that it's they've already finished their training by the time this happened. Even though it's a
when I came across matches that somewhat, it's like 2 years prior to his dad's death, he was reigning, and then his dad died, and he's got 2 years on his own. And what I read has a map being is his fifth year of his reign, Daniel's fourth year in captivity. So all this is speculation, right? That's reasonable. What isn't speculative is the fact that our sovereign God orchestrates things to accomplish stuff. That's what's not speculative. How he chooses to do it is always a mystery to us. But the reality is, it certainly appears that all this is being done for one express purpose. And it's to showcase God's glory, to showcase God's majesty, to show, because that's all this chapter is all about. In essence, I mean, just go back and look at the number of references. And the early in the week, you texted me about verses 20, 21, 22, 23, how much they meant to you. So, I mean, we can go back and forth, second year, third year, all that kind of stuff. But in the end, what's the point of the chapter?
He's got a precedent for doing this already, because he did it with Joseph. The Pharaoh had a dream, didn't know what it was. Joseph came, skinny cows, fat cows, peace and famine, and elevated Joseph up to number two dude.
Yeah, and the difference in that is that he told him what the dream was.
Mm-hmm.
In this situation, he doesn't even tell him what the dream is.
Right.
I mean, that really ups the ante significantly in this case.
And God was glorified in both instances.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a good point. Whether or not Nebuchadnezzar was familiar with Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, before this moment or not, there wasn't an impression in that this was the moment. This was the moment that had the impression that drew his attention to the sovereign God.
So we can say then that this chapter contrasts temporary kingdom that we have with the eternal kingdom as
well. Well, certainly that's the point of the dream, and we need to get to that. We've been bantering around, but the essence of the chapter is the dream and how it sets the conditions for the future. Anything else before we delve into the dream? For example, Rudy, what did you like in particular, beginning in verse 20? What were the things that jumped off the page at you?
It's a list of God's authoritative attributes, and that he's in control of all things. Verse 20 to 22, he's acknowledging who God is and his attributes. And then there's adoration and appreciation in verse 23, where he's adoring him for what he did, and giving him thanks and praise, and then giving him an appreciation of the fact that he gave him wisdom and might. And a lot of times what I was thinking about is, when I pray, it's more of a list. It's more of a, Lord, please, blah, 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 blah. And then I just lay everything out. And oftentimes, I don't sit back after the fact and say, Lord, thank you for doing this, because it led to this, 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 and this, and I saw your hand in all of this. And a lot of times, you know, I think we owe it to the Lord himself to go back and appreciate him in that. So that's what I appreciate about that.
Yeah, let's enjoy it. Blessed be the name of our God in verse 20, forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those of understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter. Quite an articulation of who God is. What did you think about when you read, then Daniel went to the house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's companions? What other story that came to your mind when you read that? Where's the language in the book of Esther? Let's go to the book of Esther. Somebody help me remember exactly what that language looks like. Should be right before like Job, right? Here. Where does she start talking and she goes?
She asked him to find the
place. Yeah, yeah, where's that at? Yeah.
Chapter 4, verse 15.
Wow, that was fast. He says, then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa. Hold a fast on my behalf. Do not eat and drink 3 days or three nights. I and my young woman will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Then Daniel went into his house and made known the matter to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Similar? How about the language of verse number 11, everyone? What did you notice about verse 11 in chapter 2 of Daniel?
It reminded me of one of your sermons, how you were explaining how God has always been with flesh in the Old Testament, in the tent, and then it moved to the form of Christ coming and dwelling with us, and
yeah.
Now... with the Holy Spirit dwelling in us. There were a lot of verses. I went on Blue Letter Bible and I just put dwelling.
Yep.
And there was a lot of verses from the Old and New Testament. And a huge difference because Israel's God is unique. You know, what my study Bible used the word unique.
Mm-hmm.
Because their gods don't dwell with the flesh, but our God does.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted y'all to see that. No one can show it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. But Yahweh sets himself apart. Yahweh is utterly different. Yahweh's been dwelling with flesh from the Garden of Eden. Yahweh likes to dwell with flesh. Yahweh visits Abraham on multiple occasions. You know, Yahweh eats with Abraham. You know, Yahweh is a God who desires to be with his people and really sets him apart from the other gods. Because from their perspective, gods don't dwell with flesh. There's a clear distinction. Gods don't dwell with flesh. And so our God takes on flesh? Our God takes on flesh so that he can dwell among us? And we can behold his glory, the glory of the only begotten Son of God, full of grace and truth? I mean, it's a giant, stark contrast. It's huge. And then we're going to find out that this is the God that actually can interpret dreams, that can, you know, because Daniel gives all the credit to God. He doesn't, for even a moment, take any credit. What else comes to your mind?
church or anything?
Yeah, anything. Like breakfast, lunch, dinner.
Yes, I don't want to I don't want to reiterate whatever she said about Esther, but I think it's very important that Daniel said, do not displace the wise men of Babylon. Not just him and his friends, but everybody that were, you know, going to be put to death.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly had to give Daniel some notoriety. They had to put Daniel in a position of prominence in a real significant way. Yeah, John.
I'm always on the alert for people taking the glory from the Lord or even from their friends. And I'm impressed in verse 23 about how Daniel doesn't say, the Lord revealed it to me. It's always us. He was in prayer with his friends for a long time. And that impressed me.
Yeah. Good.
In verse 28, he says, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries and gives made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. And the latter days typically refers to the Messianic period. So Daniel doesn't even realize it, obviously, that that's what he's prophesying.
Right. Yeah. Okay, are we ready to talk about the statue?
I think one of the things that I was prayer was made known to me was expected. Like Rudy said, sometimes we go to God with a laundry list of things that we want. And throughout my prayer life, one of the things I try to do is pray without asking for something. You just pray and praise Him for what you've already got. And I think this prayer really brings that out. All He did was just thank Him for what He had done. Mm-hmm. And in verse 22, He said, well, you made known to us the King's command. So whatever you're asking for, He thank Him for giving it to you. You don't, I think a lot of times we don't do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this prayer that He gave him, the answer to the prayer is so specific. And the answer is just amazing.
What are we to make of the fact that He doesn't say in verse number 18, seek an answer from God? Instead, He says, seek mercy from God. Mm-hmm. What are we to make of that? That language right there. Thoughts on that idea that he's asking for mercy from God? This is what we were to petition, which was to ask for mercy from God.
He's not going to dictate to the Lord how he answers that prayer. He's just kind of throwing himself on the Lord's mercy, and however the Lord wants to work it out would have been fine with him.
Anybody else?
Because they're in a tight spot. You know, like, have mercy on us, God. You know, we want to live. What's the answer? Give us the answer that He wants us to give. But all glory will be yours.
I do see it as a little bit more specific. Like, He's not just saying, like, at the mercy of God. He's very specifically saying, like, I don't want to die without either of them. And, like,
right.
I am being very specific with my desires right now. Like,
right.
I need mercy.
Right.
Save me from this death. No. He is being quite specific here.
Yes. Yeah, I think John was saying that the manner in which God chooses to intervene is at God's discretion, but He's clearly asking.
Yeah, He could have given them the interpretation or not, but maybe He would have still delivered him from the death in another manner later on, as He does later in the book. I don't want to give away the ending.
And He told them to seek mercy from God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel's companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men from Babylon. I guess what I'm trying to seemingly illustrate here is the fact that the death warrant is not coming from God, it's coming from Nebuchadnezzar. Yet he appeals to God's mercy. But it's not God who's going to put him to death, it's Nebuchadnezzar that's going to put him to death. Yet he's appealing to God for mercy.
So he's acknowledging God's control over the kingdom.
Yes, exactly, right. And that if God, in fact, does intervene, that it was God being merciful to him in his things. And today's Christians, we impugn God's character for not intervening and doing what we expect Him to do. We question the very character and nature of God. If you make God into a monster, or you make God into a murderer, or you make God into anything other than a loving, tolerant, patient, tender, compassionate creature who lives for us. But that's not Daniel's perspective. Daniel's appealing to the mercy of God to intervene. I see it as a strong and stark contrast.
Why would Daniel ask Ariok, why would he question Nebuchadnezzar's decision to kill the wise man?
Yeah, he says, then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion, which we haven't talked about, to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, whom God had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. But we saw Daniel doing that before. In chapter number 1, the same thing occurred. Daniel clearly seems to know who the right person is to talk to in every situation. In the previous situation, he appealed to, we looked at two layers down is what I remember. It was the chief of the eunuchs in eunuchs, verse number 7, that gave him their names, and then they make this resolution, and so then he asked of the chief of eunuchs to allow him to defile himself. And then God gave him favor in the sight of the chief, so God intervenes. In this case, we see him appealing twice to Arioch. Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree of the king so urgent? So Daniel seems to be truly ignorant as to what's going on. That's what seems to be happening. So now he gets the details. Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel. So now it seems as though there's a lot of information in that sentence. Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. So now he appeals back to Arioch. Can I have a moment with the king? Can you get me in to see the king? There's a possibility here that this is going to come through. And then moments later, hours later, minutes later, he goes back to his house. And he gets his prayer partners involved, is what it looks like, right? To get them petitioning God to be merciful to them so that he and his commandings might not be destroyed, as you said, with the rest of the wise men. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. So it looks like we have one single night of rest, right? And then the next day he's going to go see the king. And that night he got some information. So it appears that verses 20 through 23 is what? It's just a time of praise.
Yeah.
Right? Because he answered God's prayer. So then we go back to Arioch. We're going to go back to Arioch. And we're going to do what? We're going to say, get me back in there. Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said to us, I have found among the exiles from Judah a man who will make known to the king the interpretation. The king declared to Daniel's name was Belshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream that I've seen and its interpretation? Then Daniel answered, no wise man can do this. No magician, astrologer can show the king the mystery. King, but, and this is, we have to see this important language, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and visions of your head are, as you lay in bed, are these. And then he just lays it out. He just lays it out, what it was. That had to have been incredible. I mean, that just had to have been, as he describes it. You saw, O king, behold a great image. This image, mighty, exceedingly bright, has stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. Who do we think that the king thought the whole statue was? What?
Himself.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely, it was himself. The whole thing was himself. And why is he so scared? Yeah, because this stone comes out of nowhere, and what happens? Right, it crushes him. So what do you think he thought?
Well, Daniel says it's the last days. I think it's his empire's last days.
Yeah, but I'm talking about when he first had the dream. That night, when he first had the dream, whether he could remember what the dream was or whether he was only frightened by it. In other words, he wakes up and thinks, man, what did I just dream? And now he can't recall it. Or he's got this incredible dream and he wants to know, he's a polytheistic. Are the gods causing me to think this? Is this happening tomorrow? Is this happening next week? Is my empire coming to an end? All right, let's look at the particular language in the dream.
It seems to me that Daniel had to have amazing faith in verse 16 when he went in, he found out that, why the decree was so urgent. Arioch had to explain that to him, and he immediately said, just hold up. I've got a God that's going to reveal this to me. He hadn't even asked God for it yet, but he just knew he had that faith that he would be able to, resolve this.
Right, so how does that connect back to chapter 1?
He'd already been identified as somebody of great wisdom in dealing with dreams and interpretation.
Yeah.
I think his faith had played out once prior to, steadfast his heart in that moment.
Yeah. I mean, I think we need to say, God's not dead. We need to say God has not forgotten who his covenant people are.
Yeah.
Even though in captivity, even though they're in Babylon, even though they're exiles, God knows who they are. He still remained faithful to the covenant promises.
Right.
And
God saved him and made him fatter.
Right. But it shouldn't have worked out.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, that had to have been a faith-building moment. And those faith-building moments are supposed to set the conditions for more faith-building moments in this situation. Anyone else? Okay, so what's the issue in this section of scripture? Did anyone run into some of the issues? How many kingdoms are we dealing with? And let's just kind of lay it out. Remind ourselves.
Four.
Yeah, okay, so what's the problem with...
If you count the mountain, it's five.
Okay, right. If you count the mountain, it's five.
The,
right.
The stone that was cut from the mountain. Yeah.
The issue is whether or not the Medes and Persians are one or two.
Right.
Yeah.
Because if we go back, we've got Romans, and we've got Greeks, and then we got Persians, and then we have Medes, and then the Babylonians. Right? Did I make a mistake? Right.
The Medo-Persian Empire melded together at some point. So.
Right, and that's really the discussion. Is, are these together? And then, what's the next discussion?
The bottom one. Because it's clearly both iron, but at some point there's a change in that material.
Right. All the way down to the toes.
Correct.
Right. And you get, all kinds of interpretations. We'll get into this in the weeks and months to come concerning 10 kings. Does that mean there's going to be 10 rulers when the Antichrist rises up, because of each of the toes? I'm sure you've heard all that, John, before, right? Many times. Yeah, the 10 kingdoms, right? 7 hills, all kinds of stuff. Are we supposed to take it with that degree of literalness? Those will be the conversations we have. But let's just lay it out. It goes gold, then what?
Silver.
So do you guys think that it's best to group Medes and Persians together? What is that the research that everyone found? Then the Greeks were...
Is it partially based on the bear vision later on?
I thought you weren't going to give stuff away.
Sorry.
Right?
Not bad.
Okay, that was your premise earlier. But we are going to be going back, constantly going back and pulling stuff together. This is bronze. Sister And then, is this iron? There's an N in there somewhere.
Iron.
And what?
Iron.
Then iron and clay. And then, what's the whole point of this thing? What's the whole point of this?
The stone that destroyed it.
Right. Yeah. And we showed you that Sunday night. We showed you that stone Sunday night. Who can remember? I know there was only a handful of year on Sunday night, but who can remember? Come on, somebody please remember. Yeah, you're on the right track, sister, as you often are. All right, go back to Genesis 49. That's where we went back to, Genesis 49. And I want you to think about how early Genesis 49 is compared to where we're at now with Daniel.
49:25.
Right. So this is the first time that the stone, can I use motif, idea, metaphor, illustration, is introduced to us. This is the first time where he lays out, let me remind you, this is Jacob, and he's laying out what? This is what's going to happen to his 12 sons. This is how each is going to be. He lays hands on him. He's pretty prophetic. And then the language is, by the hand of the mighty one of Jacob, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. The stone of Israel. So this is the first time that we have this stone idea. And then it begins to carry its way out, occasionally being mentioned. And then, you know, here's this stone coming again. Now, the stone with the builders rejected is in Psalms. Let me see. Anybody remember exactly what song is?
Because obviously that's Joseph, but Jesus came from Judah. So
where do I think that he makes that distinction, sister, when he goes, I think he's, because I looked at that as well, and I think, see where he says, by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. So I think that the mighty one of Jacob is the shepherd who is the stone. Joseph is a fruitful bough by spring. His branches run over the wall. The archers bitterly attacked him, shot at him, and harassed him severely. Yet his bow remained unmoved by his arms were made agile. And then I'm suggesting to you that it's by the hands of the... this is all God's doing. This is, and then God is described, I think, three different ways there. He's the mighty one of Jacob. He's the shepherd. He's the stone of Israel. Anyone have any thoughts on that? So I believe that he's done talking about who Joseph is when he says, we're made... agile.
Right. He's not talking about an offspring of Joseph. He's talking about the mighty one of Jacob will support Joseph.
Right. And I think the mighty one of Jacob is the stone of Israel, who is the shepherd. Right. Did anyone find out where what psalm it was? Did somebody look it up yet? What?
118:22.
Right. So then, this is where we get the reference to the stone that the builders rejected. Yeah, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This is the Lord's doing. it is marvelous in our eyes. So again, Christ is the stone. You know, he's the stone. And then we're going to see the stone at least one more time in the book of Daniel.
Is there a verse to the new time? 18. Everyone who falls on that stone will
yes.
be broken to pieces, and
yep.
when it falls on anyone, it will crush them.
Right. Yep. Mm-hmm. Which is, and that was Luke what? 20 what? 18. Yep. Mm-hmm.
There's another one in Matthew. Also 1 Peter 2 4.
Yeah. 1 Peter is where he's quoting the stone that the builders rejected, right? Right. And 18 is pretty interesting. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and when it falls on anyone, it will be crushed. Clearly, it's a unique motif.
Sounds like a statue being crushed.
Right. Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, a great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. All right, anyone else have a thought for us? How about verse 43? What is the what are the Bible translations for verse 43 with regard to the clay mixing with the ESV has the word marriage, one another in marriage. What else? What are the other words you guys have?
Mingled.
What?
The seed of men.
The seed of men. That's interesting.
Might be that the people will mix with one another.
Mix with one another. Yeah, the ESV has the word marriage. As you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. What kind of description is that? What comes to your mind, John, when you read that? What are you thinking?
I'm thinking, based on some prior knowledge, thinking about Rome and how that would apply to them. I think Rome is the iron, but they had a habit, or they chose to embrace a variety of cultures and allow those cultures to flourish under their Pax Romana. And that may refer to this mixture or marriage of clay and iron, but that's speculation.
So, John, would you support the idea that that the Roman government kind of set a model for world kind of empires, and that we're just a continuation of that, we're an extension of it?
Well, you need a historian for that, because there's been a lot under the bridge since then.
Sure.
If it's been consistent or not, I don't know.
Right. I mean, obviously, we were trying to figure out the idea of the movement from the legs to the ankles to the toes. Are we talking about 2,000 years? Are we talking about a stopping point and then there's nothing more? Or do we have like a revival of the old Roman Empire, which sometimes you'll hear that prophetically talked about? Normally people who talk that will also use languages like rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem and that kind of stuff. So that would be a very literal interpretation of the text. And like we mentioned a moment ago, like the ten toes, each representing a particular king. But this idea of mingling or mixing seems to set the Roman Empire apart from the other ones. So at a bare minimum, the inclusion of other ideas, ideologies, religions, cultures,
well, if we look at Rome, the iron, when Rome was united and at its strongest, couldn't be beaten.
Right.
Nobody could stand up to them. Yeah, they suffered defeats, especially the Teutoburg Forest in Augustus's reign. But otherwise, they just couldn't be defeated. Fast forward to late in the empire, we see the Western Empire is getting weaker, and it kind of becomes a clay. More and more tribes are putting pressure on Western Roman Empire, but the Eastern Roman Empire becomes strong. It becomes the iron, while the Western Roman Empire becomes the clay. It becomes weak, and eventually it falls. Then, eventually, the Western Empire, for the most part, gets reconquered by the East, but it slowly withers away, and it lasts for another 1,000 years. So, historical, you can look at it like this, in that form, that the clay becomes the Western Roman Empire. Eventually, there's 10 major tribes that take over the Western Roman Empire. Three of those tribes are eventually no more. They're absorbed, they're defeated, they're genocided out. Now we can say 10 kingdoms, but eventually three are cut off. Is there a comparison there? Potentially.
Yeah, sure. Now, I think you could also have a conversation about the degree to which the Roman Empire embraced the Roman Catholic Church and the mingling of that religion and who's in charge. Is it Rome? Is it the Pope? And that whole mess.
Constantine the 323.
Right. Yeah.
I do find it interesting, word for word, it translates using the Blue Letter Bible, that it's mixed, it will be mixed, and then the next word is with the seed of, and then the third word is men, as you had mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, it's 7:44, we need to be dismissed.